Welcome to Becoming Church, the podcast where we discuss how the message and movement of Jesus is not just about becoming Christians, but about becoming the church. I'm your host, Kristen Mockler-Young, and my guest today is Dave Gibbons. Dave is the founding pastor of New Song Church in California, and you'll get to hear a little bit about him in this interview. And I guess you'll also get to learn a little bit about me, because he unexpectedly turned the mic back on me a couple of times. So here's my conversation and interview with Dave and myself. All right, Dave, welcome to the Becoming Church podcast.
Thank you, Kristen. It's great to be with you.
Yes, I'm glad that I caught you. You're currently in California, but I know you travel a lot. Where have you been lately?
Oh, well, recently Atlanta and in Brazil. There's a lot of fun stuff happening both on the East Coast and then also South America.
Okay. And what is it that has you traveling kind of all over the world?
Well, I do like senior advisement work. And so I work with founders, you know, CEOs, entertainment industry athletes, and I help them with their personal, relational, and their work strategies and execution of their vision.
Very cool. What's your favorite place to go?
Ooh, it depends what it is. You know, if you're talking about like innovation, technology, just kind of cool, it's Korea, Seoul.
Okay.
And that's one of the hottest spots right now. And if you're talking about just total health relaxation, it's got to be Bangkok.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Similar part of the world there.
Yeah. If you want to go like just for fun, then you got to go to Brazil, because Brazil is like the wild, wild west.
I'm trying to think. I don't think I've made it to Brazil yet. Mm-hmm. I have not made it to Asia yet at all. So I'll definitely have to get some recommendations from you and head over there.
You got to make it happen, because it's a whole new world.
That's awesome. And you are, tell people a little bit of your background or your heritage, which might explain maybe your affection for that part of the world.
Sure. I was born in Korea. My mom's Korean, and the dad that raised me was Caucasian from Missouri and then raised in Michigan. He was in the Air Force. So okay. I have a bicultural heritage and ethnic upbringing.
Yeah. And then you ended up in California. How?
Well, I was in the East Coast at the time. I had pastored a church that was a Korean church, and then I felt called to go to California. When I came to California, it just felt like this is the place I was made for. Mm. And, I love the culture of like pioneering and technology, and then all the races, the ethnic convergence was really exciting for me.
Yeah. Well, Dave, when you're not traveling, your main job, as far as I understand it, is you are the founding pastor of New Song Church.
Yes, it's one of my jobs. I'm bivocational.
Okay. Oh, you are? Okay.
Yes, I am. I started out as a lead pastor and founder of New Song 30 years ago. We just celebrated this past weekend.
You did. Congratulations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. And then about 15 years ago, I started exploring the marketplace engagement, because I felt a real propensity to figure out business, because I was working with a lot of business leaders. And so the more I got into it, the more I loved it. And the church was really gracious in allowing me to be a bivocational person.
That's awesome. 30 years is an accomplishment. It's an accomplishment. What are you looking forward to in the next year, whether it's just New Song or kind of the church as a whole? What are you looking forward to for next year or the future?
Well, you know, I think we're going through a moment within our history here in America of deconstruction and a lot of chaos.
Agreed.
And of course, we see the polarities and tribalism. Mm-hmm. There's a real fear, I think, of even a potential, you know, civil war. Hopefully not, but it's pretty frightening.
Yeah.
But I see it as a prelude to an exciting moment, which is the creative economy, where, you know, you move from chaos to creativity. So I'm getting excited that we don't have to be overwhelmed by this, the darkness that we feel and see all around us, but we could actually see this as a moment that we can shine and really do something amazing and create the dreams that maybe are embedded in our own spirit.
Yeah. Do you have an idea of is it like, do you have this creative idea kind of mulling around that you're thinking through or you're processing?
Yeah. You know, a lot of it's around the human development processes.
Okay.
And how we do human development, because, you know, in the church world, they call it discipleship.
Right.
And in the business world, it's people development or HR. And I think there's a lot of room for growth there, because a lot of it from the church side is centered upon volunteerism within the silo of the individual church. Mm-hmm. There's not often a conversation on what their gifts, their personalities, what does it look like in their homes and then in the marketplace. And I think that's where the growth is going to happen, is helping equip people not just to flourish in the four walls of the church, but how to flourish in their neighborhoods.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm smiling so big, Dave, because that's basically the heart of this podcast. Ooh. Is we want to equip our people. We want to equip the people that are listening to, yeah, not just attend church on Sunday, but to become the church to the people around them. So
right on.
I love that you see that as the future of the church as a whole, because yeah, let's start changing. Let's start shifting the way things are working, you know?
Yeah. What gave you that burden?
I think a couple things. I think one of the biggest was just the pandemic, and things shifted and things changed. Mm-hmm. And so obviously when the world was shut down, you know, it was like we had to get creative and do things differently. But almost what was harder for us, or at least I will say for me, was the rebuilding afterwards. Like the world opened up and church opened up, and we just thought everybody's going to start coming back. They're going to start tithing the way they used to tithe. All the money would be there. All the volunteers would be there. And it just has not proven to be the case.
Yeah.
So even before I was on this call, like right before I jumped on this call with you, I was on a call with my worship leadership team, which is two volunteers. Uh-huh. You know, we've had to get creative on, we don't have staff. We don't have the money for staff.
Sure.
So we're looking for people in our congregation that have, if not the worship skill or gifting or talent to sing, what can they do, you know, behind the scenes to help? And
sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Just kind of extending that and letting our people have some ownership of what they believe and how they live out their faith, you know?
For sure. And so you're finding that's the greatest challenge then, is just recruiting people to serve within the institution of the church, or?
I think serving, I think giving, you know, I think the initial idea, at least right when we came back, was like, oh, we're going to go back to how it was. We're going to reopen and just go back to what was. But what we're finding, which was a challenge, yeah, but it's also now really beautiful, is like you said, figuring out creative ways to not only function as a church business or unit, but then also helping our people to move outside of Sunday morning. You know, I think the model for a long time was you come in and you sit down and you listen to the pastor teach from stage, and then you go out and you check off the list and you live your life, right?
Right.
And it was so great that they came in, but let's also take what we're hearing and then put it into practice.
Right. So what are the biggest shifts that you're making from where it was to now?
They're a lot more relational, I would say. We started with, like I said, our staff went from, I don't know if we had like 10, 12 pre-pandemic. At one point we were decently large. Right now we have 4. Mm-hmm. So I would say the biggest shift is relying on our people to step up and to serve because they want to serve because they've been gifted to do it. And for us to recognize, you know, we don't all do things in ministry, quote unquote, because we're paid to do it. But mm-hmm. we're all in ministry. Like we're all called to do something, whether it's at the church or in your neighborhood or in your family or your workplace or wherever it is.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. Are you still having fun?
We're having fun again. It wasn't always fun. It was a challenge, but I think that's the creativity part that you added, right? Like once we were able to put aside what we thought it was supposed to be, and get creative about new ways. Yeah, it's become fun again, for sure. Yeah. How did you celebrate your 30 years at New Song?
Well, I think we're in the midst of a year of celebration. I don't want it just to be a weekend.
I love that.
Yeah. So I'm celebrating it by travel to the places that, you know, we've served and we're serving. And then this past weekend specifically, we had a formal 3-day event, a series of events. You know, one was with our former and present staff on Friday night. Saturday was a huge gala. You know, we brought back all the staff from the past and all leaders, and the church got involved. And we had like Ryan Ellis, we had Tadashi, we had some really cool music, and then, you know, people sharing poetry and memories.
Oh, and that's so
then
cool.
Sunday was just like the church gathered, and we did it as the church community locally. So yeah, so it was really fun.
I love it. Yeah, we have a unwritten value of joy, I would say, in our church. So that's good. We've got a connection coast to coast there. Well, when you planted New Song, when you started it, how did you hope New Song would be different than if California is anything like Charlotte? You know, we've got a church on every corner. What were you hoping New Song would do differently?
Well, originally it was around like diversity, because we saw a lot of homogeneous type of churches.
Yeah.
And, you know, even if it was different colors, culturally it seemed still the same, you know, because everybody starts to carry the same Bible. They start to look alike and sing the same songs. And so I said, man, I think the world's so much more diverse. Mm-hmm. You know, so how can we broaden that? And then secondly was more deeply is the idea of reconciliation, is, you know, what does it look like to love and become community with somebody that's different culturally than you, but more than that, someone that's hard to love, like say someone who's houseless or someone who's going through addictions. How much time do we engage that? And can we make that a primary focus of our relational development?
Yeah. How are you guys achieving that practically? What's been something that you've really gone like, okay, this has worked really well in the last 30 years?
Yeah, a lot of it's around mindset. Is, you know, you a lot of times we as a church, we come in to impose our solutions, or we try to win people to Jesus. That's, you know, which is awesome that we're trying to see people come know God. But it feels like an agenda, and it's manipulative. Yeah. It's a bait and switch type of thing.
Right.
And so be nice to them so they come to your church. And so I think the mindset shifted. Well, what if the whole thing is just to love them and figure out what their dreams are and then help them move towards their dreams, which may not include your church. And so can you honestly approach people that way? And so it's really a reshaping of our mindset and how we engaged.
Yeah.
And it's more like a love really being the purest thing. If we can love that way, I think it'd help us. So we think about like our sons and daughters. How would you want a pastor, like if I sent my child to your church or in Charlottesville, you know, or Charlotte, like how would I want you to treat them?
Right.
You know, and I wouldn't want you to treat them like a number and just put them through your normal playgrounds, right? But would you get to know them first?
Yeah.
And then maybe if your church isn't the style that you could recommend, hey, there's this other church down the street, you'd be perfect for it. Or, you know what, you shouldn't be in church as a volunteer. You really need to be in the marketplace, and we'll support you there. You know.
Yeah, that's so great. I think I surprise new people all the time when they visit Mosaic, and, you know, I'm asking them questions and telling them what we're like. And then I often will say, and hey, if we're not the church for you, let me know what you're looking for or what you're not looking for, and I will help you find the place that is. I'd rather you be in church. It's not about being here. It's just about you being in a community and finding your people. So
absolutely. Absolutely.
And, I get, you know, that.
And then I think also just from like a analogy perspective, usually we think of ourselves like the city on a hill. We're just huge functioning beacon of light. Everything that we have within our silo is what you need, really.
Right.
And so I think the idea shifted towards more of an academy model. Like we're more like an X-Men academy.
Okay.
We're here to equip the mutants. And you don't have to stay here. In fact, most people, and they say in America, stay 1 to 4 years in churches now because of the transient nature of the economy.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you only have 1 to 4 years, then it's like a university setting. So how do you help people while they're there to feel like they're flourishing and then also feel connected to community? Mm-hmm. So the academy model frees things up. And I also think it helps with dealing with some of the social concerns that we have with LGBTQ+, and then also with those who may have a different social agenda approach for mm-hmm. life. You know, if you have more of an academy model and not just the typical church institutional model, then you're going to be more accepting and respecting of where people are coming from versus like a club where you're either in or out, depending upon if you're a member or not.
Right. I love that. Yeah. Our church runs, I think, very similarly to the way that yours does. So I'm so excited just to hear that there are other people and other pastors, you know, doing it in a similar way. We referred to it a while, you know, we're a very transient city too, as like we were a revolving door. We just felt like every time a family or a couple or people came in and we got to know them, that then something would happen and they'd be on their way out. And honestly, Dave, for a while it grieved me and it was really hard because I'm like, we invested so much time in you and, you know, and we got to know you and even relationally and emotionally invested so much. Then to see people go for one reason or another was hard and it was sad. And God really just had to change my mind. Like you said, mind shift of, no, this is actually a really good thing. Like, it's a great thing. If we had the same people in week after week, I mean, I'm sure we could still help them grow, but we get to reach even more people for him. We get to build into the lives of even more people because there's always a new batch coming through. And it changed everything when I kind of saw that as a good thing instead of a burden.
Yeah, it's hard because those are the conversations that we normally don't have as pastors or leaders. Like, how do you let people leave well? And then how do you actually celebrate someone's leaving? Because usually the members, they're not going to be loud about it. They're quietly leaving. And then you go, well, why did this person leave? I haven't seen them in a while.
Yeah.
And then they're kind of, if you see each other at the store, you're kind of avoiding each other. And, you know, to me, it's like, can we make it a way where there's like these honest conversations where people are? It's just like, again, you would be like a student or counselor at a university.
Yeah.
Where you're talking about, hey, where are you planning to go? What are you planning to do? And then, yeah, you should try this other school. This other school will be really good for you. You know,
yeah.
And then let's celebrate though while you were here. We want to graduate you from our place. You know, I think that would make it so much more easy, I think, for people to see that, hey, you probably do need different places to grow. It's okay.
How have you solved this problem, Dave? How do we do this?
Well, we're working on it. You know, and it's a lot easier now because we have over the last 10 years. Emphasize the academy model.
Okay.
It's actually allowed for us to create a more of a culture. So we did away with membership. And so it's more participants.
Yeah.
And so it really helps a ton in terms of just helping receive people, launching people and their mindset when they come to church.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned, I think there's a misconception. You kind of blew past that. I want to circle back real quick, and that might be a good transition into the book that you recently wrote as well. But you mentioned that, you know, your church or your community looked racially different or culturally different, but was still pretty homogenous, as in everybody was still kind of the same. Unpack that a little bit.
Yeah, it was mostly like our church started in Irvine, California, which is like upper middle class, educated, more affluent, you know. And so even though there are people of different color, you didn't see the social economic diversity. And, you know, you didn't see the homeless coming in or the houseless coming into your community.
Yeah.
And so I noticed that a lot. And then also, if I was honest, it's a pretty transient church community was attending too and coming. You know, maybe up to 80% were disenchanted Christians who stopped going to church or were the new cool thing. Yeah. And so it was really the subculture of Christians, and there's different shades of where they are in maturation, but it was again mostly Christian or people who had wandered away a little bit. And so we were diverse, I think, in terms of Muslims and Buddhists and agnostics, atheists.
Sure.
You know, that they would gravitate towards coming to our community.
Sure.
And so that's what really was a conundrum for me, because when I launched New Song, and if you talk to typical church planners, they'll say, oh, we're a church for the city. We're going to reach those who don't know God. And if they're really honest, not really. Right. And so you're reaching people who don't like their current church, or they left a while ago. And so I said, man, I want to figure out, how do we really get in the middle of Babylon and love people there and help them flourish? So yeah, that's been the shift for me.
That's great. Is there a practical, like, for the people that are listening, if they want to kind of, you know, because we always are trying to invite people in, you know, yes, not necessarily the ones who are coming from the church, like up the road. but was there something practically that you did? You know, I know you mentioned programming and the academy model, but that kind of made your church, that made New Song more attractive to the other or the non-Christians?
Yeah, it's kind of, again, reimagining what church is. That church isn't just hardware, like a place and a set of buildings and a set of programs. It's more like an operating system that has, you can use different apps, but it needs to be plugged into the right power source, of course, the Spirit. But if you see it more as an operating system, you can take it into any hardware of an organization, like a company, like an artist cohort or collective. And you can take that operating system and make different apps that they could apply what church looks like in their organization. And when I saw that, I said, oh, you can't stop that type of movement. But if you only plant the hardware church as we know it, with the Sunday services, small groups, children's ministries, you know, you add all the programmatic pieces, then you're only going to reach a certain, you know, per slice of the pie. And I said, the whole holy grail to me is, what if we're dropped right in the middle of Babylon? How do we start engaging within these communities, the life of Christ in the community? And so that's been the fun part. So the mindset has to shift from just hardware, programmatic stuff, which is good, but also thinking, okay, how do we go where people are? And if they never came to our church, how do we help them to create church where they are?
Yeah.
Because what is the, you know, if you look at the raw essentials of church, you know, what would it look like? And usually it's around communion and food, right? Mm-hmm. Or food. Mm-hmm. It's around meaningful conversations, which would include spiritual conversations about, you know, God or their higher power. And then it'd be play, and then some type of missional, purposeful, like action. And so you can actually incorporate that into any hardware, that's where I said, oh, and then I said, what is that though? If you take the essential element of what church is about, it's Ephesians 4, equipping the saints.
Yeah.
And I said, well, that's human development, people development. So that's what you target then within the companies, within the networks, is help the founders, help the leadership to develop people. Yeah. And if you can do that, again, you start to have this huge impact. And that's what I've seen over the last 15 years. As I started working within companies, the very people I'm trying to reach to come into New Song, I don't have to reach them. I'm actually like blessed by the Pharaoh or the king of the company to come and serve the people. And they want to meet with me because they see that I'm serving the founder and I'm offering him or her really great advice.
Right.
And so they go, hey, can I meet with you? Can I see you?
Yeah.
You don't have that as a pastor when you're talking about the marketplace.
Yeah. Well, it's the focus, right? Like, it's outward focus. It's not inward focus. It's about the people. It's not about getting them into your church. And I think people can tell. They can tell the difference, you know? I love that your church started that way. Mosaic is just about to turn 19 at the beginning of in January, which is super exciting, but we've always been diverse. I don't want to say we've shifted. I think we've become over 19 years more of who we were always meant to be, if that makes sense. So our mission is to reclaim the message and movement of Jesus, because same idea, right? We did a whole series on reimagining and what it looks like to reimagine God and Jesus in the church. And when we did that series, actually, Dave, we lost some people because they were like, what do you mean? Like, what do you mean we're going to reimagine and we're going to think about it differently? Because I think a lot, it's easier a lot of times for people to go, just give me that church model. I just want to jump into this. Mm-hmm. And it might be a little bit harder to be outward focused and focus on the people, but that's actually what the gospel says to do.
Yes. Yes. So have you worked through that then? Where are you now?
Yeah. We're sticking with it. We are really, you know, in our messaging, in our sermons, in our groups, in our teaching, everything. Again, that's where this podcast was even born of, was that idea of let's equip our people and help them to own their own faith. We just love people with open hands. Like we said a minute ago, if they decide Mosaic's no longer for them, then, you know, we try to find something else for them in the city that is. And that's okay.
No, I get it. You know, I found too, because, you know, you're asking like, how do we help move people in that direction? I think what helped too, as well, was this idea that when we go with the listener mindset, listen and learner, versus like answer person, and then to spend time getting to know people, again, without the agenda to try to bring them in. And then what's really fun about it is if you can listen to the Holy Spirit at the same time as you're listening to the person's voice, there is this magical moment that occurs. And it's what we've always longed for. Those, I think, who've gone into ministry, you know, they went in it with this really high ambition, to see God at work in their city or nation. And I think we've been trained with Saul's armor on how to do church and how to do the programs, but we don't really know how to engage the marketplace in a real authentic way. Because I think most of the world now knows that there's so much bait and switching going on. And it's so manipulative that they're just turned off by it.
Yeah. The next generation especially, I think, sees right through it. So churches better jump on board, I think.
Yeah, right.
Before we finish the conversation, I wanted to pop in really quick and let you know that I was surprised at how much Dave and I seem to have in common in the first half of this interview. Then I almost cried twice in the second half. If you're inspired by a new way to live as a Jesus follower when you listen to this show, I'd love for you to do two simple things. One, make sure that you're subscribed or following along so our episodes automatically download for you. I also encourage you to go back and check out any past episodes that you may have missed. Secondly, please share this episode. Text it to a friend who's maybe not vibing with the current state of churches around them, or share it on social media and tag me at Kristen Mockler Young. It's when we use our voices together to share this different version of Christianity that true change can really happen. All right, now get ready to go even deeper with Dave Gibbons. Well, Dave, you have a book that came out a few months ago called The Shape of My Eyes, a memoir of race, faith, and finding myself. Give our listeners a little bit of background or a summary of what the book is about.
Yeah, I wrote it to those that are searching for home.
I
feel this is kind of a lost generation around the world. And, you know, it's a fatherless generation. So I thought, well, how can I address this? And during the pandemic, I felt compelled to go deeper into my life background, because I had a diagnosis of PTSD, and I was wondering, where does that come from? And so that took me down the rabbit hole of exploring more of my past, my parents' past, and then Korea's past. So the book's purpose was really, I think, to help people find home and then find healing and to deal with some of those hidden areas of their life so that they can flourish once again. So I do that through the narrative of just diving into my story.
Yeah. I know you mentioned that you were looking to your past for clues. How would you encourage our listeners, like if they wanted to look to their past for clues about who they are, how would you suggest that they could start doing that?
Yeah, I think there's a couple ways. One is maybe do a timeline of zero to where their current age is.
Okay.
And then write down all the key milestone events of your life, painful and joyful. And you can either write it or draw a picture. And if you don't want to write it, then do it with a set of friends where you just chronicle your life and key moments without, again, trying to interpret it. But just at first, just kind of writing it down, documenting it, processing it. And then I think what you want to do then is if you recorded it or if you have a group of friends, say, well, what did you hear from that? Like, what did you see, or who do you see that I am as a result of that type of this picture I drew of myself from the data of my life? Yes, I think that's a really good exercise if they want to try to explore more who they are and find themselves. And then I think the other thing would be is go to your culture of origins and explore the generational history of it all. You know, talk to your parents, talk to your aunts and uncles, talk to people from that you maybe don't even know, and just interview them. And then do searches on the internet just of the place that you were raised, because there's always a sound in the ground that that you're listening to subconsciously, but it becomes a part of your identity. So I think those are a couple, I think, helpful things to help people process.
Yeah. I think for somebody asked me, I was at an event the other day and somebody asked me like, what's your background? What's your nationality? And I was like, I'm as white as white can be, pretty much. And that's not 100% accurate, but I think it's easy for people like me who are just like, I'm white, I'm Caucasian, to go, oh, I don't need to do this work into my historical cultural background. I know my history because we learn it in school. But I don't think that's actually true. I think that's a way for white people to just go, like, I don't need to do the same work as everyone else. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think so for a lot of people. Because, you know, most people in America are immigrants.
Right.
You know, they come from immigrant history. So I think it's important to look at your roots. Like, what caused your grandparents or great-grandparents to come to America? Mm-hmm. You know, what were they running away from? Or what were their dreams that were compelling them to come this direction? Mm-hmm. And then also, what were some of the traumas that they dealt with? You know, what were some of the history of their families? Were there abuses? Were, you know, was there racism that they experienced or that they were perpetrators of?
Right.
You know, so, right. You know, there's a thing called epigenetics. I'm not sure if you've investigated it, but it's the idea that your genes, they carry the physical characteristics of our families.
Right.
But there's a belief now that your genes can also carry memories from the past and traumas, that they're imprinted in your genes. So that's why sometimes, you know, you may be in a setting or with a person, you're getting some type of allergic reaction, is because it's tapping into some of the, you know, something inside your genes. Or there's something that people can't get over, like an addiction. And then if you study it, it's like something that's gone in your family for generations. So there's something to that. And I think to explore it, you know, for the Caucasian or for a person who thinks there's, you know, that they have no real ethnic heritage or culture, I said, no, you do. Just explore it. You may find some answers to why you feel the way you do.
Huh. That's really interesting. I've never heard of that before.
Mm-hmm.
And I think too, I mean, anytime we think we know our history or we know everything, that's probably the first sign that we need to go back and start asking questions and learning some more, you know. If the last couple of years have shown me anything, it's that what I was taught even in school, you know, what I was taught about the history of our country even is not 100% accurate, or it's only one side of a multifaceted story. And so, yeah, I think even for people who feel like I can be tempted to think, you know, there's not a lot of background or, you know, cultural things that we bring to the table or to the people around us, there really still is, if we would dig into it.
How has your identity changed, the way you view yourself?
Regarding, well, in lots of ways, but regarding what?
Just in regard, like if you're to describe yourself to people when you're like 18 versus your age now, how would that change? How would that have changed?
I think I've figured out who I am now at the ripe old age of 41. I think I've figured out who I am now, you know, when I was 18, probably even when I was like 27, I would have said that my identity was really in who my parents raised me to be, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, I was the daughter, and so I had my parents' political affiliations and I had their belief systems and my faith was their faith. And, you know, we learn from our family of origin and there's nothing wrong with that. But yeah, now I'd say I've figured out who God has made me to be, why I'm a little bit quirky, why I'm a little bit extra sometimes, you know, things that I would have put aside for a while or that I thought were supposed to be quieter, kind of put to the side, maybe reserved only for home. Now I can live into that. I'm like, oh, God did this on purpose, actually. No, the more we learn about ourselves, right, the better, a deeper understanding we can have of who God made us to be as individual people, reflections of a very unique piece of him, I think.
What would your 18-year-old self be surprised about who you are now?
I think my 18-year-old self, would probably call my current self, I don't know, a heretic or some like leftist liberal or who knows. My 18-year-old self would be shocked at the friends that I have and the people I love. And not only the fact that I use my voice to like fight for injustice, but the kinds of people that I'm fighting for. You know, I'm getting ready to go to the Mexican border actually for like an immersive trip across the border to learn about immigration and migrants and refugees. And my 18-year-old self would have been like terrified, just an absolute fear that something was going to happen. And, you know, I would have never, ever stepped out of my own little bubble. So
that's fantastic.
Yeah. I'm proud of who I am now, Dave. Yes. Thank you.
Yeah. That's to be celebrated.
Yes. Well, I think that when we talk about, you know, people and backgrounds, a lot of times when people hear the word discrimination or we talk about, you know, race in America, it's still pretty black and white. Like we talk about white people and we talk about black people. And then there's just kind of like everybody else is grouped into kind of an other. And the Asian American population, I feel like, really doesn't get the same airtime, for lack of a better word, as the Black Americans. And not that I want to take away from anybody else's experience, but I do want to educate people on your experience. Is there a misconception that you think the majority of people have about Asian Americans?
Well, you know, it's hard to stereotype, but I think generally speaking, that we were always looked upon as the model minority.
And okay.
Yeah, like, you know, hardworking, educated, quiet, and they just do their thing. And really that myth was used to weaponize racism against the Black community. And, you know, so So that myth is really a myth. It's not really true. There's such a wide range of diversity amongst Asian Americans. You know, we're not a monolith.
Exactly.
You know, so I remember when New Song first started, we were primarily Asian. And they would, when they said, oh, that's the Asian church, they would think of it as a monolith. But they didn't realize like there's 15 different Asian countries represented here. And, you know, just like Japanese and Koreans, like black and white. Mm-hmm. You know, in terms of cultural and racism and prejudice. And so, yes, I think that's probably one of the biggest misunderstandings, this idea of the model minority, that it's a very diverse type of group of people. And then secondly, that there's a lot of racism that's been experienced amongst Asian Americans. You know, with the Exclusion Act early in our history in America, where, you know, Asian immigrants weren't allowed to gain citizenship. And then the treatment of Asians with the building of the Transcontinental Railroad system, mm-hmm. and the internment camps with the Japanese. Right. There's been a lot of hostility, and then recently you saw the elderly Asians being attacked and abused and killed, yeah. and then with COVID, you know, they thought that was an Asian thing. So I think there's a lot of prejudice and racism that's not addressed. So even when you talk about race conversations, it's like you said, there'll be black, white, brown, but you don't have like the Asian statistics or representation, when in reality, we're at least 10% of the American population. And we are probably the most educated group minority wise. And then one of the richest, if not the richest group in terms of this wealth. And then from a global perspective, Asians are huge. You know, my understanding is a majority of the global population. So it's just a really skewed understanding, I think, of Asians' influence and impact in the society.
For people that are listening and they're like, okay, I don't want to be part of this. I don't want to perpetuate this. What can they do? I know, obviously, like, we want to listen and learn, you know, maybe they don't have any friends that are Asian or people in their church that are, but they don't want to kind of let that leave them complicit, right? What's a step that they can take in changing their own mind or helping to bring Asian Americans into the conversation?
Well, I don't think the motivation is going to be there for a lot of Christians unless they see it as a biblical mandate.
Okay.
We really follow the word of God. So I think if they can be inspired by the word, it versus just like feeling guilty or I got to do something. So I say, look at love God, love your neighbor, the most important things that every church is built upon. And in the Bible, you know, when Jesus was asked who my neighbor is, he says, it's someone, he told the Good Samaritan story.
Yeah.
And so basically he was saying, it's someone not like you.
Right.
So my understanding of this is that to know God, you need to love the other, someone not like you. And so the more you can love someone not like you, the greater the understanding you'll have of God. And so if Asians or Asian Americans are people you just don't understand or get, then make it an intentional part of your scheduling where you literally put these amount of hours I'm going to spend with the Asian community, learning about Asians or spending time with Asians, taking them out to a meal, and just learning and listening, not trying to, again, impose solutions.
Yeah.
But most likely, even in some of the secondary cities of America, you have refugees, you have Asians that are within your reach. Go to the restaurants, go to the fairs, the cultural festivals, and just spend time learning. And then if you have the resources, you'll want to go to Asia. And you'll see how wonderful it is. Is there so much more advancement? You know, we think it's so primitive, like, oh, they're way behind. It's like they are light years ahead in terms of technology, cleanliness, the buildings. It's just unbelievable. And so I would say, yeah, you'll see it's a whole new world.
Yeah. It's on our list to go. We will make it there one day. Dave, really practically, really practically. I love that you just said, you know, commit a certain amount of time, take people to lunch, whatever. I want a very practical, like, what does someone say? How do I go up to you and say, Dave, I want to take you to lunch. I want to, you know, hang out from you, learn from you, without you just hearing basically me say, like, I need an Asian friend. Please step in and be my, you know, be my, like, DEI person, because that's not at all what we're trying to do. Like, how practically can they start to foster those relationships without it seeming performative?
No, that's so good. I appreciate the authenticity about the question. You know, usually everything's within your hand. You know, when Moses says, I don't know how to do this, God says, what's in your hand? And so I would say, hey, what's in your hand? Mm. What are the relationships in your circle right now of Asians that you've taken the class with, that, you know, maybe you're not deep friends, but you're friends? And then when it comes to, like, your kids and the schools, you know, are there Asian kids that your kids play with? Yeah. You know, maybe, again, they're within your reach. Maybe invite them over to your house. and say, hey, love to have you over the house, or invite them to an event.
Yeah.
And again, just taking the time to know them without being weird, you know, just normal, you know, relational stuff, asking questions and listening. But again, there's probably normal relationships within your reach. That's whether it's through your own past or your relationships that you currently have, that it just takes you a moment to reflect, like, how do I go deeper with this person without being weird and kooky and engage them? So
I think we overthink it. We're like, how do I ask? Really, it's the same as anybody else you would invite over. You don't jump right in with like, tell me about your ancestors, or like, what brought them to this country? Those are not normal questions.
I know.
Get to know people first. And then I think it just kind of naturally will come into conversation over time. It doesn't have to all happen like in the initial conversation.
Well, the great thing too, you know, since you're a church leader.
Yeah.
You can model it. Like, I've had some really cool friends that, you know, they created things called Medici Knights. You know,
okay. The
Medici family was the family that, you know, they were a wealthy family that brought all these different cultures together. And when they did, it sparked the Renaissance movement. And so it's a really great concept that, hey, what if we have like these Medici Knights where we invite people of different backgrounds and cultures to have dinner together. And then maybe we share stories or we have questions. And so I'm helping leaders to do that around the country and world, where I say, hey, you know, take some intentionality, but if you have authority and people like hanging with you and you're a good networker, most likely they would come for a really great chef-inspired dinner.
Yeah.
And for good conversation. So there's a formal way you can do it too. If you're a person that's a leader or you enjoy bringing people together, you can do it in your house.
Yeah.
You can do it at church. And it's a wonderful experience. People will want more.
I love that. Yeah. Be a connector, right? Be a host.
Exactly.
Get people in the room.
Exactly. Like, we just did one in Atlanta with my friend, and he had a person who's a sommelier come talk about wine from South Africa. He brought wine. Fun. And then we had a poet, you know, and then we had someone who did breath work. And then they did an interview, like, when I was there, of my book. And people were just loving it. And they were all different faiths or backgrounds, races. And they go, can we do more of this?
Yeah.
And so they've already done two, and they're going to start regularly doing them now.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, and even like you said, as a leader, we had recently hosted a couples night at our church. And so we catered dinner as part of the event for, you know, couples, part of their ticket. And so we were like, well, let's do something different. So we actually catered in from a Puerto Rican restaurant for dinner, instead of just doing like Chick-fil-A or Italian or even Mexican, which people love. But as a diverse church, it's important to us when we host our events now, we bring in and help people experience food from different cultures that they maybe never did. It's like, if we can ease them in these tiny little ways, it just starts to become more and more normal of part of their life, you know?
For sure. For sure. We did a series called Us.
Okay.
And we just thought about all the people that normally don't go to church, and people, or people that are, our community may be afraid to approach.
Oh, that's good.
Transgender, gay, yeah. Black, brown, you know, an addict, you know, someone who's in addictions. And we just interviewed them, you know, in front of everybody. And so you demonstrated, like, before the community, how do you have a conversation that's normal? And we had a person that won RuPaul's drag queen.
Yeah, and, Drag Race.
So he won it, and then he won the recent one that it was like all the drag queens from the past that won, he won it.
Okay.
He's the brother of the executive pastor of our church.
Okay.
And so I said, would he mind coming? Because he hadn't been to church in decades.
Sure.
And then so I said, I want to interview him in front of the congregation. And so he agreed. And in the middle of the interview, he just starts crying. I go, what's bringing the tears? He He said, I just feel so loved and there's no judgment here. And our community got to see that. So any type of like misconception or preconceptions they had about someone who may be transgender or struggling, they're saying, oh, this person's like, I like him. It was beautiful. And I said, man, I think so as leadership, we can actually show a modeling, I think, because sometimes people don't know how to do it or they're scared, and you're showing them, how do you have a conversation that's honest and real and loving?
Right. That's so beautiful. I'm tearing up just listening. The second we get off this interview, I'm going to look up that series. I'm going to listen to all of them because that is so just the truest picture of what Jesus actually called us to do. To our neighbor is everyone. Our neighbor is the drag queens. Our neighbor are the trans people. It is everyone. It is truly everyone. And if, you know, back to the start of the interview, right? Like, we've got to get creative on what the church of the future is going to look like. And it's got to be a place where all of our neighbors and all of these people and all of the misfits, as I like to call them, feel like they can fit in our churches. And if not, then I think we're doing something wrong.
Yeah. Why are we doing it, right? Because what's the big deal if you can love someone just like you? You know, the miracle is when you can love someone not like you, especially an enemy, you know, that you would love someone who's betrayed you, is unfathomable for most.
Yeah. Well, Dave, because the podcast is called Becoming Church, I'm going to ask you one last question, which is, how can the people that are listening become the church to the people around them, maybe especially to the people that they're afraid of getting to know?
I think it starts maybe with a simple prayer where you say, God, give me your eyes for the way you see people. And then, you know, because obviously maybe I don't see them the way you see them, but would you give me your eyes? And then as you get to see people like you've never seen them before, you start to see them as really beautiful.
Yeah.
And, you know, even though there's people of different political persuasions and people we like to cancel out of our lives, you know, you start to see everybody made in the image of God. And when they're acting up or saying stuff that's like vitriolic or offensive, it's almost you feel sorry for them versus just getting angry. You just feel sad.
Yeah.
And so I think when you get the heart of God and his eyes, it just changes everything. So I just tell people, when you just start praying that simple prayer, is that God would just help you to see people like he sees people.
Yeah. Oh, and I would say, here I am getting ready to cry again, Dave, because that's exactly what I did. As soon as you said those, I prayed those exact words a few years ago. That's what brought me from 18-year-old Kristen to now. And it truly was that prayer. And I have seen God show up and answer that over and over and over and over again. You know, we change our eyes, we change our minds, we change our hearts, we change literally everything about the way we live our lives in relation to the people around us. So.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. Thank you very much.
It's interesting too, because you can't do that unless like you're fully present with somebody.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you have like the typical evangelical perspective is, you know, we're always future about Christ coming, about heaven and mission and vision, but it's taken us to a place where it's hurt us to be human again. And so I think, if you can really see he's fully present, he's fully with you right now.
Right.
So I think everything changes if you can see like he sees. But I'm glad that you've made that shift. It's obvious. So it's exciting.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. And I will hopefully forever be changing and transforming and growing. That's the other thing is I'm like, don't ever let me think that I've arrived, because and I'm sure there will always be more work to do.
For sure.
For sure. Well, thank you, Dave, so much. We will link up. I'm going to link up that whole Us series in the show notes, as well as your book. Is there anything else that you wanted to say to our listeners today?
This is probably one of the most exciting moments, I think, in history since I've been alive.
Yeah.
I think it's the moment the church has been waiting for. Mm. You know, this is our opportunity in the midst of tribalism, hate, vitriol, you know, potential civil war, to really be love And so I say, you know, let love guide you in how you engage, you know, more than just a position, a political position. Think about how can I demonstrate love, even to someone who doesn't agree with you. Yeah. And I think if people see that, I think that'd be the truest witness of who God is and who the church needs to be.
Amen. That'll preach. That'll preach. I mean, come on. If you've been listening to Becoming Church for a little while, you were probably nodding right along with me as Dave was sharing his heart, because it is mine as well, and truly the heart of this podcast. If you're a new listener and this idea of doing a church in a new way is appealing to you, it really is what this podcast is about. Follow along with me on social media for some fun behind the scenes, and so you can appreciate and thank the guests who come on and teach us so honestly how to better look like Jesus in the world around us. Be sure to grab Dave's book on our Amazon resource list and check out his Us series on loving all of our neighbors. Until next time, thanks for listening, and keep becoming the church to the people around you.